This is the fourth in a series that I have done this week based on some issues that have come out of Economic Justice for All. This is the pastoral letter of the U.S. Catholic bishops that was in its final draft, put in its final draft last November 86. And this final draft is the result of about 5 years of hearings and drafts and redrafts. The first draft was submitted to the National Conference in November 84, and they had planned really just to do two more drafts and make a final draft in 85, but they extended the time, and this came out in November 86. I don't know how many of you may have been here at one of the earlier sessions. Essentially, what the bishops do is say that we need some additional criteria for making judgments about an economic order. That today we judge whether our economy is healthy or not simply in terms of whether there is economic growth, whether the stock market is going up or down in terms of the Dow Jones averages, or perhaps in terms of the average income going up. But what the bishops want to do is to say that there are some moral criteria that we should use in addition to these traditional economic criteria. And so after a rather lengthy section on economics and the Bible and giving regard to Catholic social teaching, particularly over the last century, they develop an understanding of justice as participation. And they talk about basic justice is a situation in which everybody has the obligation as well as the opportunity to participate in a community or society. Now, if somebody has an obligation to participate, they may need some tools to participate. And so the bishops argue that, for example, in our domestic economy, that we as a society have an obligation to see that people have the things they need to be fully participating members. And so they've come out with a kind of economic bill of rights that has created quite a debate about this. The basic idea of justice is participation. And they go on to expand this by talking about we need to look at what economic policies and institutions do to our sense of community. Now, what they say often happens is that we think of communities simply in terms of a group that gets together and makes money from each other. It's a kind of, often our groups are simply a kind of mutual self-interest. And so they hearken back to what they regard as a more biblical, a more Christian notion of community that is based upon love. And what they're saying is that human beings are social creatures, and we can fulfill our deepest needs as human beings only in a real community. And whereas they don't say that simply changing economic policies and structures is going to create that community, they do think that some economic structures and policies encourage community more than others. Another part of this idea of justice is the dignity of the individual. And kind of the bottom line, I guess, on this idea of justice as participation is what they call the preferential option for the poor and the marginalized. That the poor and the marginalized, these are the people that are kind of on the fringes and are not participating because they don't have the motivation or other tools to participate. And so what the bishops are saying we need to do is to develop strategies that will try to bring the poor into our society as participating people. And they make recommendations regarding employment, regarding the whole scope of policies designed to attack poverty. And they have, interestingly enough, a section on American agriculture and are very concerned about what's happening to the traditional family farm. And the fourth area that they address in terms of specific policies has to do with the relationship of the United States to other nations. Now, because of this, what they call the preferential option for the poor, they focus in this section not on relationships between the United States and Japan or the United States and Great Britain or Germany or Canada, but on specifically on relationships between the United States and the developing nations, or sometimes we refer to these as the third world. Some economists would put about 60 countries in the third world category. Others would include 80 or 90. And there's some economists now that would like to even talk about a third and a fourth world, because even in the third world you've got some great differences. But basically, when we talk about these developing nations, we're talking about half of the world's population. We're talking about 2.5 billion people living in countries in which the per capita annual income is less than $400. I have had opportunities to visit really only one developing nation. That was in East Africa. And the lady that came and was the maid in the hotel, which was a fairly modest hotel, on several occasions I had a chance to talk with her, and her annual income was about $330 a year. And the reason I found this out was I left at the after we'd been there a couple of days. I left a 40 shillings, this was Kenyan shillings, which would have been about $2.50, kind of as a tip for her. And before I could leave the hotel, she sought me out, because that she regarded that as such an extravagant tip. And I mean, for me, $2.40 was, a mere pittance, almost. I mean, for her, that was a gold mine, almost. About 800 million people in those same countries live in virtually absolute poverty. And 500 million, half a billion, are chronically hungry. In those developing nations, 15 out of every 100 children will die before they turn 5 years old. And many others who do survive survive with some severe handicaps because they've not had adequate nutrition, and therefore you have increased incidence of mental retardation and physical, stunted physical growth. Now, when you begin talking about the global economic order, it gets very complicated, and neither Barry nor I claim to be experts in this matter. But when you talk about the economic order, you're talking about three basic kinds of actors. First of all, you have the individual nations themselves. You have the United States, and you have Brazil or Chile or Kenya or Nigeria or whatever. So you have the individual nations. These are one set of actors. Then you have what are called the multilateral institutions. Now, these are basically institutions that have been set up by several countries to serve. In fact, most of them were set up. The most important was the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the GATT, which is the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. All these were set up in Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. This was an attempt to forestall the kind of economic conditions that led to World War II. And so these are three of the most important kind of multilateral institutions, although GATT is not really an institution. It's a treaty that has, there is an office for it, and various kinds of agreements about trade and tariffs were continually negotiated in Geneva, Switzerland. UNCTAD is a United Nations Conference on Trade and Development that was developed in 1964. And the developing nations were not really a part of the Bretton Woods Agreement. And so they feel sort of left out in that, because the northern industrial nations more or less control the World Bank and the IMF. And so UNCTAD was a meeting in which the developing nations tried to represent their own interest in terms of international trade and development. Now, the third set of actors, so you have these kind of multilateral institutions. Usually the World Bank, for example, traditionally has made loans for specific projects in a country. Say a country wants to build a dam or something, or build a highway, the World Bank would be the institution that did that. And traditionally the International Monetary Fund has had the responsibility of helping developing nations with cash flow problems. I mean, for example, they would be in a situation in which they were going to, need cash now, but the sale wasn't going to go through till later. But more recently, the IMF has taken on quite a different role, and Barry's going to talk about that in just a minute. Now, when you talk about justice in the global economy, there are at least four areas. One has to do with direct assistance from the industrial nations to the developing nations. Over the last 10 years, and particularly since the Reagan administration took office, the the aid that the United States gives to developing nations has declined in real terms. And I think right now, in terms of, if you compare this to our military budget, for example, we give in international assistance about 4% of our total military budget. And two-thirds now of that direct assistance is for military purposes. And so, you know, we're in terms of aid that really goes for developing infrastructure like highways and education and things like this, we have drastically cut back on that. We have cut back on our contributions to the World Bank, to the IMF, have really kind of withdrawn from a lot of that. The recent Law of the Sea Treaty that was negotiated among the nations, so far as I know, the United States has not yet signed that. In other words, we're getting a reputation internationally for being a kind of bully, really, and simply not cooperating in areas where most of the rest of the world is quite cooperative. So you have the whole area of assistance, of direct aid to countries. Then there are matters of trade, having to do with prices and what kind of commodities are to be traded. The areas of finance, and we're going to focus on that in just a minute. And finally, you have the whole area of investment, from particularly from foreign companies. I'm not sure I mentioned the third actor here in the international. That would be your transnational corporations and banks. You know, we have a lot of corporations today that they're not just an American corporation or just a German corporation, but they are multinational. And many of these are so big that they have a gross income that far exceeds the gross national product of some of the countries that they're in. And so, you know, they do have enormous economic power. Now, one of the there are a lot of places we could focus, but one of the areas that is so critical today regards third world debt that is owed primarily to first world banks. And my brother Barry, I'm very pleased to be able to do at least one session here together. And he's such an expert on all this that he gave me an extra hour to sleep and stuff like this. He has done some work on the whole problem of the debt crisis, and so I'm going to let him address that and then we'll talk about that.
Okay. I don't know why the flies are all following me, but
I think that the debt crisis is, when it comes to issues of economic justice in the global community, I guess I personally feel like it's probably the one most pervasive and perhaps most serious problem that we have. And I also think it represents in itself the ways in which the first world, and especially the United States, really does relate to the third world. So that we find within the debt crisis situation a lot of sort of parallels that we find in the way that we treat the third world economically and a lot of other areas as well. So what I'm going to try to do is go through a very complex issue and just try to summarize in a few minutes what it's all about by talking about what the situation is, what do we really mean by the debt crisis, talking about some of the history of it, how did it happen, and what the effects are of the debt crisis, especially with the involvement of the IMF, on third world people. And then just briefly talk a little bit about the some of the proposed solutions and some of the U.S., some of the ironies of the U.S. involvement in that. And let me just point out that a couple, you can take a look at these afterwards, but there's a, I think some of the best sort of summaries of the debt crisis that are put out from a faith perspective. There's a group from the World Council of Churches, that an advisory group on economic matters, the International Financial System, an ecumenical critique is very good. The debt crisis in the third world is another publication from the World Council of Churches. And then there's also the International Debt Crisis Network, which is a coalition of groups that has put out, I think this is probably the best summary that you will find, that goes into a fair amount of detail and I think is understandable to most non-economists. There's also a workbook that goes with that. And there's some stuff that's been put out by Oxfam that I've really been drawing on. And this is from the Lutheran Hunger Appeal. Actually, I have some extra copies of this, which I forgot to bring down. And if anybody's interested, I can give you those. At this particular time, the third world owes to primarily Western banks and governments, a little bit to Eastern Bloc banks, around $1 trillion, which comes out to be about $400 per person in the third world, which is less than, as John just said, less than the average annual income. So they owe per person more than they make per year. That has just skyrocketed in the last 10 years. In 1975, Latin America owed $75 billion totally. In 1985, they owed $300 billion. It's four times what it was 10 years ago. Some of the individual debts, Brazil owes about $108 billion, Mexico $102 billion, Argentina $53 billion, Nigeria $23 billion, and go on and on, Indonesia $43 billion. And basically, it's gotten to a point where the third world simply cannot keep up with their payments. They can't even keep up with the interest, much less pay on any of the principal. Just to quote Henry Kissinger, whom I don't usually quote, but anyway, these payments simply cannot be made. None of the major debtor countries will be able simultaneously to pay its debt, achieve economic growth, and maintain its political and social equilibrium. And that's coming from someone who is obviously on the conservative end of the spectrum. I mean, he is essentially saying it can never be paid. The crisis, as we call it a crisis, really began in 1982. When Mexico, you probably remember, there was a lot of stuff in the news when Mexico was essentially going bankrupt, and that because they couldn't continue to pay their debts. The crisis really began a long time before that, but that's when most people started noticing it. But you have a situation where countries are now in a situation of paying 6 to 10% of their entire gross national product just to pay interest. Just for the seriousness of it, Brazil pays in 1986 almost 40% of its entire export earnings it pays in interest. So in other words, for all the money that it earns selling goods to other countries, almost 40% of that goes just to pay the interest on its debt. Mexico, Argentina are basically around the same in the high 30% range. Chile's about there. Other countries around 30%. Colombia, Indonesia. Almost all of them, I have about a chart here of most of the countries in Central America and some in Africa, and they're all paying at least 10% of their export earnings.
And that's just to pay the interest.
That's just to pay the interest. They're not even paying on the principal at all. So basically, we have a situation where the third world, most economists would say, is in the worst depression since the 1930s. Now, how many times do Americans hear that? We don't hear that. But the third world is in a desperate depression right now, and a lot of that's due to the debt crisis situation. So, how did all this happen? You can really trace it back in some ways to, if you really want to begin, and I'm not going to say much about this just because of time, but to colonialism. And you have a situation where Western European countries primarily are settling what is now the third world and creating an economic order in which it's primarily the third world who are supplying raw materials and cash crop commodities like coffee, sugar, cotton, those kinds of things, to the first world. And you'll see why that's important in a minute. Then you have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank that are set up in 1944. And essentially they're set up to, for a number of reasons, but one of those is to monitor loans and the balance of payments. And that particular part of their power has really grown and expanded over the last 15 years. In the 1940s and 60s, you had a lot of things going on. You had a lot of colonial powers becoming independent, but you had a lot of money going into third world development projects. And it seemed like perhaps in some ways that was actually being successful to some degree in terms of sort of pure economic terms of looking at the gross national products of countries, and there was some growth in the third world. But then what happened in 1973 that was sort of crucial? Do you remember waiting in gas and lines? All right, oil prices shot way up. Now two things happened with that. Number one is that simply the price of oil became extremely high for third world countries to keep what they had of an infrastructure going. So what they had to pay out to get basic oil needs was, you know, double, triple, quadruple what it had been in the few years before. At the same time, you have the oil-rich countries that are making bundles. Now they have to do something with that money. And what they did primarily with it, or a lot of it at least, went into Western banks. So Western banks have all this money now that's sitting in their banks. Now, banks pay interest on the money that's sitting in their banks to the people who put that money in there. So what are they going to want to do as quickly as possible so that they can turn this money into, instead of a source of something that they're having to pay out on, they want to turn it into something they can earn money on. So they're going to lend it. And there's stories about how representatives of American banks literally just chase down third world government officials at parties and all through. There's all sorts of stories about how they just simply would not give up on these people. And they had all this money, they wanted to get rid of it. And obviously if they're paying out at that particular time, let's say they were paying out 5%, they're going to want to loan this money at higher interest rates so they can make money. And that's the way banks work. That's the whole idea. So they just started loaning money in any particular way they could all throughout the third world. A lot of that money was not very well planned for. It wasn't well used. Some of the money did go for basic infrastructure needs, for basic government services, roads, highways, some for social programs. A lot of it went for large construction projects. All of a sudden, everybody was trying to convince third world countries that they needed all these huge development projects. They were starting to build nuclear power plants and all sorts of things that cost huge amounts of money. A lot of those things now, the total cost by the end is 10 to 20 times what they thought it would be. And the people, who do you think really benefited from those investments? It's primarily foreign investors. So the people in the country itself really weren't gaining anything. And if the idea was to promote development, that wasn't happening either, because most of the money went into projects that really didn't increase productivity in the country itself. A lot of money went into military. Some went into what we call capital flight, which is simply the elite in the country getting money and then taking it out of the country so that they can protect it. Some estimates are that between 1974 and 1982, $84 billion was taken out of Mexico, Chile, Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil illegally. That's one third of the debt that they accrued during that time. Interest payments were another way in which some of that money was used, and a lot of it was lost to corruption. A lot of the officials used the money for a bribe, or the money was used for bribes, or that sort of thing. So basically, a lot of money went into countries and really didn't help develop them very much. Well, then you have a situation where commodity prices start falling. Now, I've just said that most of these countries have an economy that is centered on exports of things like coffee, cotton, sugar. I mean, that's the examples of a lot of countries. In other countries, it's different products. And those prices, I could talk for a long time about sort of the history of those prices, but those prices have never been stable like other prices in the world. The first world countries have always refused to agree to any kind of stabilization of those prices. They always want those prices to be completely up to the market at the time. And because of the power of those countries, usually they have a lot to say in what those prices are. So in the mid to late 70s, a lot of those commodity prices fell. Now, I have some charts here that I could show you. If you're interested, you can look at them later. But just one example. In Tanzania, if you were going to buy a truck, now they are importing. See, the problem is they have to import most of their equipment. So they're having to pay more to get things in, but they're getting less for the commodities that they're selling. I hope you're understanding basically what I'm trying to say. But if for the same truck to be bought by Tanzania in 1970, that they would buy in 1976, to buy that same truck in 1981 would cost three times the amount of coffee exported than it would in 1976, or three times the amount of cashews, four times the amount of cotton, or 10 times the amount of tobacco. So essentially their export value, and say tobacco, is one-tenth of what it was just 5 years before. So obviously they're not getting the income that they need to start paying off debt. Now you sort of have a double whammy, because what also happened in the late, or say early 80s? Right, okay, that's true. Oil prices go up again, so they're hit again with having an increase in the oil prices they have to pay to get oil to run their infrastructures. And in addition to that, you have a situation where interest rates from 79 went way up and have come down a little bit, but they're still higher. The interest rates are still significantly higher than when most of these loans were made. Now these loans are not, most of them were not loaned at fixed interest rates. They were loaned at float interest rates. And the interest rates are determined by the London Interbank rate, which is a bank of interest rate that fluctuates with the market. So again, these countries are getting loans at, say, 7% in 1977, and by 1981 they're having to pay about 12%, and even now they're still paying probably 10%. Just to give you an example of what that really means, for Mexico's debt, a 1% increase in interest means a $700 million increase in their yearly interest payment. So you can see why for Mexico's debt, if we look at their total debt now, essentially say it's 3% greater than it was when they took the loan. That means their interest payments are almost, are $2.5 billion probably dollars more than they were when they originally started. So it's just sort of this vicious cycle of the situation where they cannot get out of it. And the question is sort of, you know, what we do with that. The one thing I do want to make clear is that the third world, we usually think of all the aid that goes into the third world, and we think of the third world sort of getting more from the first world than we get from them. Well, that is simply not true. In 1984, the total transfer of funds, and this is including all aid and gifts and everything else that went from the first world to third world countries, the total amount of transfer is from the third world back to the first world in the amount of $18 billion. And in 1985, that was $25 billion. And that's when you add everything up in terms of loan payments, in terms of aid, in terms of balance of trade, and all that sort of stuff, the third world is paying the first world. The poor of the world are paying the rich of the world. That is,
there's a net outflow.
There's a net outflow
from
the third world
to the first world.
That's right. And that's something that we don't usually realize. All right, well, what does that IMF have to do with all this? Well, the IMF is a major actor in this whole thing. Most of the loans that are given to the third world have conditions put on them that essentially requires that country to abide by the recommendations and requirements of the International Monetary Fund. Now, if you're trying to help a country get out of debt, if you're trying to help them produce income so that they can pay their interest payments, what are you going to try to help them do economically? Yeah, right, exactly. At least that's what the IMF wants to do. You want them to export more than the import. You want them to have a net income as a country. And that's exactly the priority of the IMF. That's what they do. They come in and they look at the economy, and they really look at it almost entirely just in pure sort of economic terms of how can we increase exports. So what they do is they create what are called adjustment programs. And there's several things that they do with that. First of all, they require austerity programs or austerity spending within the government. They go in and say, okay, you have to cut this program, social program usually is what it is. So education, welfare programs are cut back, health programs are cut back, because a lot of people are unemployed. One example is in the Dominican Republic. I think within the course of 2 years after the IMF policies were followed, there were 12,000 government employees that were laid off because their departments were cut or cut back. Another thing that happens is that usually involved in those cuts, food subsidies are cut. In Zaire, the subsidy on cornmeal was cut in 1984. And immediately, cornmeal, which was one of the very, very basic foodstuffs of all the people in the country, shot up 70%. The price of cornmeal went up 70% in literally a month, I think. And I think there's been some adjustment on that now, but that's what happened. I mean, it really has led directly to a lot of hunger. Another thing has been that there have been import tariffs put on things coming into the country to discourage people from buying and importing things so that then more energy and economic power will go into producing things for export, and that you won't waste money buying things to be imported. Now, what happens is then that countries that have an economic system that is based almost entirely on things to be exported for money, like coffee and cotton and sugar and those kinds of things that don't do them much good nutritionally, are dependent on importing their goods. So even things like some very, very basic things baby formula, for instance, is one example in Nigeria. Now, we can get into a whole discussion of baby formula and whether that's a good thing or not, but at least in this situation, here was a mother who had already gotten to the point of being dependent on that baby formula, and because of the tariffs, that sometimes the cost can be $35 for 500 grams of baby formula in Nigeria. That's not all the time, it fluctuates, but when it runs through a particular cycle, at the end of that cycle, the price shoots up. Very often, right. Another policy is often devaluing the currency of that particular country. And I don't think I'm going to go into that, but just to say, those of you who do understand that, it would mean that you would just simply say, on the world market, our currency is now worth less. What that does is that it makes it more expensive again to buy things and from other countries, because your currency is worth less on the world market. It means that you can export more because prices of your particular exports are less on the world market. So again, it's a way of doing that. I think I will just skip through some of the other particulars of the IMF and just read you this is sort of a personal example, or one specific example of how this all happens. This is a particular situation in the Philippines. A peasant woman in Mindoro Island, the Philippines, held in her fist a bundle of gnarled mud cake roots. "This is what we have to eat," she said. "This is all we have to eat, even on holidays. Look what we have been reduced to." Most families in Mindoro have access to 1 or 2 hectares, 2.5 to 5 acres of rice land. According to Charney, who works for Oxfam, the rice they plant, if grown with enough fertilizer, ought to yield at least 3 or 4 times of unmilled rice per hectare. But Mindoro farmers have been able to harvest only about 1.5 tons of rice for each hectare because they cannot afford fertilizer. After paying land rent and money borrowed for last year's planting, they are left with only enough rice to feed a family of 6 for 4 months. Fertilizer prices have risen out of the reach of Filipino peasants because of a national fertilizer shortage. Fertilizer imports have been reduced and for a time were stopped altogether because they were absorbing too many of the dollars needed by the Philippines to pay its foreign debt of more than $27 billion. There's also another example in here of the Sudan, where we have read about the great famine in Sudan, and yet they say that there really is enough food in Sudan to feed a lot of the people, but the problem has been that they simply don't have the infrastructure to pay to transport it to the places where it's needed. I'll just read the last paragraph. "During the 1960s and 70s, Sudan received large loans from commercial banks and multinational agencies like the World Bank. In line with World Bank advice, Sudan invested much of the loan funds in export agriculture, including more than 300,000 acres in irrigated cotton. Because of the high cost of imported pesticides, fertilizers, and fuel used in raising cotton," here's another example of where the fertilizer prices and pesticides are going, prices are going way up while cotton prices are going down. So what happens? "The crop costs the country as much as and possibly more than it earns by selling it." Nevertheless, the money borrowed for this and similar projects must be repaid. So that is essentially what's happening. And the IMF is essentially, I think in most places, going in with blinders and saying, well, what we have to do is increase exports. And so that's what they do. So the people who are paying for the third world debt are the poor of the third world, whereas I think the people have to take responsibility for it, or the elite in the third world, as well as the bankers and government officials in the Western world, including the United States, because they loaned out a lot of money completely irresponsibly. And yet, right now, the people who are paying for it are the poor. That's essentially what has happened. Now, even still, you know, you had... up until even the last couple of years, the IMF and the World Bank still encouraged more loans, even in spite of this whole situation. And in fact, what was happening was that as things got worse and worse, third world countries had to borrow more money just to pay for the old loans.
Just refinancing the loans.
That's right.
Over it.
In 1983, 79% of every dollar newly borrowed was used just to pay the interest on the previous loans. 79% of the loan was used to pay the old loans. So, I mean, it's just like this incredible vicious cycle. They borrow more. And yet, the IMF is encouraging that. Now, why? All right? The third world can't buy our products if they don't have money. All right, that's one. And they'll openly state that. We have to keep the international economic order going. They have to have money to buy our products, so we loan them more money. We have to prevent them from defaulting. We don't want one or two countries to start saying we're not going to pay, because then what does that do? Everybody's going to start doing that. And it's profitable. Now, we hear this real song and dance and cry from the banks, but the reality is, and they're going to get hit with this now, but it's their own fault, and we're going to pay for it as well. In 1970, the profit on third world loans from the seven largest U.S. banks was about 20% of their total profit. So they made about 20% of their total profit on third world loans. In 1982, the seven largest banks in the United States were making 60% of their total profit from third world loans. Now, one specific example, Citicorp is one of the largest banks with loans out. Made in 1982, it made 20% of all of its profits just off of the country of Brazil. So, I'll just say this, and this might not make a whole lot of sense, but the real issue is not the payment of the principal. Most banks don't really care that much about that. The international order will continue to be okay, and everything will be all right, and the banks will still make profit as long as everybody keeps paying their interest, because the cash will keep flowing. So that's what's happening. That's why they're willing to keep loaning it out. Because as long as the interest payment keeps coming in, everything's working. But of course, that still ignores the effect it's having on the third world. Let me just end up here, and then we can talk. I just want to say that I think that the third world debt crisis has become, I think consciously on some people's part and unconsciously in a lot of others, another way in which the United States especially is really controlling the third world. We're not doing it militarily, we're doing it through finances and debt. Let me just read a quote from Julius Nyerere, who from Tanzania. He's the former president of Tanzania. He says, "The Europeans have problems, the United States has a huge internal deficit and a huge external deficit. U.S. high interest rate policies are adding to the entire crisis. That's something I didn't say. I mean, one of the real reasons for these interest rates is because we have our national debt going out of sight. And yet we're imposing all these austerity measures on these other countries. And I should say that the IMF has 148 members. But your voting power in the IMF depends on your economic power. So the United States has 20% of the voting power in the IMF. And the Western world has, I think, about 85% of the power. So essentially, it's the money who are making the loans that control all the policies. The third world has no say substantially in it. Anyway, so he's talking about the United States. He says, does the IMF go to them and tell them what they should be doing to deal with their financial problems? These institutions have become the instruments of a new kind of empire. And I think we really need to consider that. That essentially what we're doing is controlling the third world by this debt crisis. And I think that's another reason why some people don't really want to completely solve it. As long as we can solve it so that we're still getting interest payments, that's okay. We don't really want to solve the problem. Just to end, I'll say that there's a couple things that I think are really ironic in this. First of all, the United States has now become the largest debtor nation in the world. And I'm not talking about our national debt anymore. I'm talking about in terms of investment. There is now $331 billion more invested in the United States by foreign investors than the Americans had invested in the rest of the world. In 1982, we were the largest creditor nation in the world. In 4 years, we went from the largest creditor to the largest debtor nation in the world. And yet, we're the ones that are imposing austerity measures on the third world. And we're going to have to pay for that eventually, too. But Reagan ignores it and says that that's a symbol, that the foreign investment is a sign of increased confidence that the rest of the world has in the United States economy. And that's the way he dismisses the problem. The other thing I think is really ironic is that the third world debt crisis really affects the United States too. There are a number of industries that are manufacturing industry, export-oriented industries that now are high in unemployment because we cannot sell our products as much as we used to be able to the third world. And the farm crisis is also directly related to the third world debt crisis. I won't go into that in detail. And then just the last thing is just to say that there are a number of ways of approaching this. Everything from people who say that the problem is really just a short-term cash flow problem. And all they want to do is essentially keep loaning more money and maybe a few little adjustments here and there. That's essentially what the Baker Plan is, which was proposed a few years ago by the Secretary of the Treasury. That goes all the way through in the whole spectrum of people who want to forgive some of the debt to the poorest countries and write it off. Some of the plans are to forgive the debt essentially, but require that they put the payments back into their own economy. Senator Bradley has a proposal that we essentially drop the interest rates 3%, have a moratorium for 3 years, I think, and then start it back up again. And other people have other things in between. It's very complicated because if we said, well, if you just forgive the debt, then the problem is that in our economic system, that would mean that probably banks would then not loan to third world anymore. Or if you say, okay, we're going to decrease the interest rates 3-4%, who's going to pay that? Somebody's got to pay that interest rate between what they're paying and what the world market is. Because if nobody does, world banks aren't going to loan to the third world anymore again. Because why are they going to loan something at 10% if they can loan to somebody else for 13%? Well, that's higher than it is now. I'll stop there. That was... Yeah. I don't have much. much time. But
what kind of experience and all have you all had?
Well, I have questions.
Okay.
For the actions that some of the banks have been sitting for, one of them.
Oh, I was going to mention that.
To declare losses on the basis of some of that third world debt, is that a hopeful sign, or what are the implications of that for the third world?
We were just talking about that earlier today, and I was talking to Jack Nelson Pallmeyer about it. I have to go back and look at some of the details of that. From what I understand, Citicorp has essentially said we're going to set aside $3 billion as a reserve. They have not officially written it off, but essentially that's essentially saying we're willing to accept that. The problem is that I think that's still a pretty small percentage of what they, even as one bank, have loaned out. And it doesn't, I don't know about
that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think
you're saying
everybody's
going to.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
The Reagan administration was highly critical of Citicorp for doing that because they saw that as a kind of open statement of losing confidence in the ability of the third world nations to pay, and thought that might be kind of the beginning of a kind of domino thing. So
why don't they just stop paying if they're just destroying themselves by paying?
There have been meetings of countries in Latin America to form a kind of cartel, much like the OPEC cartel.
Right. What has happened is Peru has, what they have done is they say, we will continue paying, but we will pay 10% of our export earnings. So they, although their interest payments are more than that, they tie it to that. Brazil has stopped paying, temporarily at least. Ecuador has said they will not pay any more this year because of the earthquake. Argentina is trying to renegotiate. I think that the effort to form a cartel is sort of losing out.
I think it has at this particular point.
But a lot of them are not paying. And I think a lot of people in Latin America are encouraging the step that Peru is taking. The problem is, and I have an article here on that, is that what has happened is when Peru did that, now they can't get any, or they're getting, find it very difficult to find loans.
But as long as you keep loans going, you keep a system of dependency.
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, that's a whole idea.
The country store, isn't it? The company store. The blacks have the same problem.
That's right.
They charge you more than they made, and they end up in a hole.
Right, and that was a way of keeping you there. I mean, you couldn't.
I've been to a huge shopping complex, a big mall. I'm sure it's not the biggest one in the world, or even in the United States, but it's another, but to the north side of Mexico City. And as soon as you get out of the parking lot, while you're there, it's like you're in the middle of America someplace, and just gorgeous shops and all kinds of big parking lot. But once you get outside the parking lot, it's the same old Mexico right outside, with people earning their living by selling dung in the street. It just doesn't fit.
Who buys it?
The people with money. Mexico does have people with money.
See, and that's another thing that we talked about possibly including it, as soon as you can't do it in an hour, is the whole thing where we're experiencing more and more where U.S. companies are taking their operations in third world countries for much lower labor costs. And a lot of economists are saying that if we don't start adjusting wages in the third world, both sides are going to suffer, because what you have is that you're going to create an economic system where there can be no consumption. Unemployment goes up in the United States, so consumption goes down. So you have example of a Detroit auto worker who's laid off. All right, people in the United States cannot afford to buy as many cars as they used to, but people in Mexico, where the company's going, don't make enough to buy a car. So consumption levels go down, and it means the entire economic order drops to another level.
I heard a story years and years ago about a Ford plant in Brazil. decided to pay the workers American wages. You know, as a as
so they can afford sort of better cars, then.
Yeah, and what happened is the workers would come to work 1 or 2 days a week, and they had what they needed. And
yeah, right.
They didn't show up the rest of the week.
I love it.
Yeah. See. Well, one proposal I've heard is not that you create the same wages, but that you tie the wages to a level of productivity, so that wages in Korea may still be 1/4 of what they were in the United States, but there's still consistency of productivity, and so you still have the consumption of the goods being produced is still.
I think another big problem with the whole system is that the loans are always made for things that are not appropriate. They don't use appropriate technology.
Yeah.
Instead, they use kinds of technology that means you have to buy what you need abroad.